You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Matt Cardle answers back, Facebook's U-turn, bakery misogyny, Iceland reviewed, and two more tracks are added to the pretend iPod.
Hello everybody, here we are once again. It's the Parish Council, the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. You're very welcome. I'm Magnus Shaw, and out on the wild and windy moors sits Terence Dackham.
Hello. Sure. I'll tell you what, Magnus.
Yeah.
Here's the thing, though. No. Here's the thing. You know how on This Week, Andrew Neil asks Michael Portillo for his moment of the week.
Mm.
I hate that. I absolutely hate that. Don't you? Yeah. It makes me cringe. Because yeah. he does his sort of like a terrible sit-down stand-up routine. And he says, oh, and here's Michael Choo-Choo Portillo. And it's excruciating then as he lumbers into, so, Michael, what's your moment of the week?
Yeah, it's like the nickname stuff as well drives me bananas.
Michael Choo-Choo Portillo. Yeah. Well, anyway, it's not my moment of the week. This is my faux pas of the week. Because rather like you, I suspect, I try to meander through life without upsetting people. But I scored a corker of an own goal this week, yet again reminding us of that useful adage, never forget famous people use Twitter too. It's another one of those. I mean, you've been guilty of this sort of thing in the past. I always think, oh, that's not going to happen to me again, and then I do it again. I was reacting to the result of the Great British Bake Off final, of which more later. And I mentioned on Twitter that I thought we would see more of Ruby, the photogenic runner-up of the contest. And one of my friends, one of our friends, Helene, queried this and said, oh, do you think so? So I said, well, look at X Factor and the success of One Direction. They didn't win, but the winner, well, nobody remembers Matt Cardle. Within seconds of me putting that up, nobody remembers Matt Cardle. The Cardle himself, obviously constantly searching his name on Twitter, was on to me, very politely saying, ahem, in a tweet, if you can say ahem in a tweet.
Was it A-H-E-M, something like that?
No, it was like, it was like more like, question mark, exclamation mark, question mark. So, of course, we tweeted back and forth with me sort of offering a cringing apology, and we left in cordial spirits. Of course, what I meant to say, see, I didn't mean to be rude. What I meant to say was that you didn't have to win a reality show to become successful.
No.
In other words, you know, One Direction didn't win, but, you know, they're a bit more successful than Matt Cardle, and he won it. But I phrased it really terribly and upset Master Cardle. But as I say, we were okay in the end. So the motto, Magnus Shaw, is never ever forget what you post on Twitter can be seen by the whole wide world and Matt Cardle.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we can add him to that exclusive club, can't we, of people we've upset on Twitter. So Matt Cardle and Nicky Campbell and...
yes, that was one of yours.
And the actor, Tony Gardner.
Tony Gardner, who at the time I was working with when you made a comment about him on Twitter.
I think I called him a C-list celebrity or something.
Yes. And then the next day it was quite amusing to see him on set. Thank you so much for that.
I mean, it's okay, isn't it? There's no rule that says... that the vaguely well known have to be inured from mild comments on Twitter.
I just don't like upsetting people unnecessarily. It was just a silly, thoughtless thing that I said. But here, Magnus Shaw, here now, you're not usually someone who puts down a marker for us to talk about an aspect of sport. But you've picked up on the incident in Moscow where Yaya Toure of Manchester City was picked out by the home crowd in Moscow on a Wednesday. Yaya Toure is black, and a section of Moscow attendees allegedly made what are called monkey noises whenever Toure touched the ball or was playing at the end where the group were standing. But there's a particular aspect that you've picked up on this issue.
Well, I mean, you know how much I follow football.
Zero.
I follow small garden insects more than I follow football. But this cropped up as a sort of international news item, you know, above and beyond the sports reports. So I did hear about this, and it just occurred to me that I don't know how many festivals and gigs I've ever been to, but it runs into the hundreds, and I've never ever once any of these occasions, and I've been to some rum do's, you know, I've been to free festivals on the tops of mountains and you know, tiny cellar clubs in dubious parts of Soho and such like, but I've never ever heard a music crowd go at a band on racial terms. You know, I've heard bands booed and such like, but I've never heard racist chanting at a music event, and I doubt I ever will. And but this seems to happen quite a lot in football, and I just can't for the life of me puzzle out what's the difference. So you've got a gathering of the public there to witness an event that they've paid to see, and yet they deliver this to the players, which would never happen at a gig. And I for the life of me can't see what the difference is. It also occurs to me that if it happened regularly at music events, it would be increasingly difficult to stage music events. Licenses would be, you know, withdrawn and withheld on those grounds. Oh, well, every time we let you do one of these, the authorities would say, we have a racist incident, so you're not having any more. And yet football rolls on.
Well, that was an argument that, very rare that you're in line with Mrs. Thatcher, but that was an argument I think that Mrs. Thatcher put forward at the time when there was a lot of hooliganism in English football, particularly in the 1980s. She, I remember quite notably, said to the Minister for Sport, you know, we need to keep your football hooligans off our streets. And he retorted back saying, no, we need to keep your hooligans from your streets out of our football grounds, you know, thereby implying that it's not a football issue. I don't think it works quite like that, because, for example, I don't have an ultimate answer, because it's really just idiotic people doing stupid things, but you don't really get this issue, for example, in rugby union. You again will get clubs against clubs with a mixed variety of backgrounds, but you don't get any racist chanting in rugby. But and you do in other sports, which I maybe just mentioned in a moment. But I think the great difference between going to a music gig and a football match, yes, they're both a gathering of crowds, and I'm not excusing it for a moment. There's virtually very little in life that makes me want to weep more than picking on somebody because of the colour of their skin. Is that when you go to a football match, it's a gladiatorial aspect. It's it harks back literally to gladiatorial times, where one person or group was pitched another person or group, or a lion, in fact, or whatever. You know. Whereas at a pop music gig, nobody's against anybody else. So you can almost, it shouldn't be, but a football match can sometimes, if you look into the psychological aspect of it, it can be like a substitute for war for young people. You know, we haven't had a massive war, you know, that involves a whole country since 1939 to 45. And so there's groups of mainly men, I'm afraid, with adrenaline and testosterone rushing around their bodies, which when they were doing national service or at war would have been used up in that way. And this is an outlet for it. But I don't think it's football's problem. I think it's a people problem. It's a country problem. It's a society problem. Do you agree?
Well, I do understand what you're saying, that a rock concert isn't gladiatorial. But, you know, most sports are gladiatorial, and it only happens at football, or does it?
Well, no, I don't think it does. We can go... I was thinking about this, and I went back probably too far for anybody's memories now, of course, but the 1936 Olympics were in Berlin, and Jesse Owens, black American, won 4 gold medals and caused rather wonderfully great distress to Adolf Hitler, who was there, you know, in his maniacal sports of the Orion race. But up to date, it does happen in other sports. Andrew Symons, cricket, Australian cricketer, mixed race, he suffered extraordinary abuse playing test cricket in India recently. And I have to say, I have a lot of Asian friends and have worked with many. And I have heard older Asian people make disparaging remarks about black people.
Yeah.
And it makes me, you know, cringe. Mm. But I've heard it in conversation. That's not saying all Asian people don't.
No, sure.
People. I'm just saying it's my experience. Tiger Woods, who you'll know even if you don't follow golf, of course, but he's been on the receiving end in golf in quite, you know, grim ways, I should say, by fellow golfers. So you know, it does happen. I think it's anywhere where. I'm afraid one person or team or group is pitched against another. And I remember we talked about this back in the days of the John Terry court case, which was cleared, of course. But we said at the time, if you make a racist comment, does it make you a racist? And I argued with a kind of bit of a sort of liberal hat on, I suppose, or I don't know if you'd call it liberal, but you know, it doesn't necessarily, because in that context, that gladiatorial context, another player or another group of supporters are saying something to put off or hurt the opponents. And so they go for the weak spot. So if someone was, for example, here's the thing. It's obviously it's not racism and it's not as hurtful. But there's this myth that the Chelsea footballer Frank Lampard has a few extra pounds on him. I mean, he doesn't. It goes back to when he was at West Ham and he was a teenager and he had a bit of teenage puppy fat or whatever you call it. But opposition fans, when Chelsea are playing, like nothing more than chanting "you fat B word" at him. Yeah, and you know, that happens where he goes all over the country. Now, I don't think those individual supporters actually think that Frank Lampard is fat. And also, if they met him, they'd probably say, "Oh, Frank, can I have my photo taken with you?" But because he's playing another team, they're trying to upset him or put him off his game or however you want to view it. And in no way am I condoning people who do that, you know, make awful noises towards a player who happens to have slightly darker skin than, you know, a few of the others. But I do think there's an element of that about it, that people are doing that because they can and because it puts off the other team. I don't think if they met Yaya Touré, I imagine, again, many of them would say, "Can I have your autograph? Could I have a photo with you?" So it doesn't excuse it. I'm just saying, you know, how it happens.
God, I think this is why I don't like sport.
I don't blame you. It's a horrifying aspect.
Yeah, it goes to the very heart of why I do really enjoy gigs, and I really have no interest whatsoever in sport, because it just, you know, I think this is what put me off it at school, apart from the weather and the, you know, freezing to death and all the rest of it, and being compelled to do anything, but it's just that notion of this sort of combative, you know, arena that we had to be thrown into. I have no taste for it at all. Perhaps that's the very spirit of sport, and it's the aspect of sport I like the least, so it's not surprising I don't really follow sports at all. So.
No, I don't blame you. And I think I wrote about this maybe a year ago about why I don't go to football matches as often as I used to. I used to be a season ticket holder at Chelsea and go to every game. Now I'll go maybe once a year, and each time I go, I say I don't think I'll go again because of racism. I don't hear racism at Chelsea, but because of the crowd behaviour, which is obnoxious, rude, sweary, and belligerent.
Yeah.
And, that puts me off. It's as simple as that.
So what you're saying is we need an enormous world conflict, armed conflict, to defuse the whole thing. All will be well.
That would do it. That's the answer. Yeah. I mean, also, just to tail it off, I mean, the effect that there are campaigns, Magnus, in football, and they're well-meaning. There's kick racism out of football, and the show racism, the red card. But the effectiveness of these campaigns is very questionable, because just because, as happened at Moscow, funnily enough, on Wednesday night, a banner was passed around with one of those kind of, you know, slogans on it, you know, show racism, red card or something. So that shows the effectiveness of these campaigns. They're well-meaning, and I don't knock them at all, but I'm not sure how effective they are. My view is, this is what we should do. It's very simple. Identify the culprits. It should be easy through CCTV. We've done it over here in the UK. We have found people making monkey gestures and making monkey noises. They've been taken to court. And, this isn't very the liberal me now, but they get a slap on the wrist. What I would do is deal with them severely in terms of prison and fines, because it's not acceptable. A prison sentence, a hefty fine. And then, I think, which would probably be even more painful to them, make them report to a police station when their team is playing a match for the next 10 years. Yes. So, you know, if it's a, God forbid, a Chelsea supporter, every time Chelsea have got a game, you have to go, at what would be half time and sign a register in the local police station. Yeah. So you couldn't possibly go to the
or
game.
Or go to a gig. That,
or go to a gig, yes. Yes, exactly. Well, having said what you said earlier, I was very much, with my ties with the Clash and so on, very much close to the Rock Against Racism movement of the early 80s and attended many gigs. And, I'm actually a peer in the film of Rude Boy, which, much of which is set at a Rock Against Racism gig in Hackney, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, my pals were all signed up members of the Anti-Nazi League in the 70s.
Absolutely, it was an Anti-Nazi League.
Yeah, we were nippers, we were 13, 14 or whatever, and we were all signed up to that for sure,
That didn't mean there was particularly a racism problem in music. It was just musicians using their voice to rail against...
I think the ANL were formed as a response to we were tilting in that direction, weren't we? There were sort of infiltrations of the National Front and various segments of the skinhead community, if there is such a thing, who were trying to use punk gigs as a recruiting ground.
They were, but I always felt these people were peripheral.
It was really gratifying that the bands involved grouped together and said, it might be peripheral, but we're not having this, and we stamped it out. As I say, there's no sign of anything like that.
No,
since then.
But isn't that a reflection on society, Magnus? Because I'll tell you, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, probably have, and feel free to stop me before I go. But, one of the things that gives me great joy going into London as regularly as I do is if I drive in and maybe it'd be a meeting. I've got friends who live in North West London, around the sort of Harlesden, Kilburn area. And if I drive through Harlesden or Kilburn at school chucking out time, it gives me great joy to see children of, let's say 9 or 10 years old. And you'll see a girl from a Somali background arm in arm with a white girl who's teasing an Asian boy who's kicking a ball with, a guy from Eastern Europe or something. Do you know what I mean?
No,
these days, I think we are integrated. Of course, there's always going to be some idiots as elements in society. But I think the reason that hopefully we don't need Red Wedge or the Anti-Nazi League or Rock Against Racism is, as you rightly say, we pretty much, hit it on the head.
Well, we do it so much better than other countries. I was talking to a guy over in the States, an American guy, and he said that. He said that, "I wish we had your ability to accept people from different racial backgrounds." So especially the further south you go in the States, they still struggle with it. They still struggle.
Undoubtedly, yes.
So we do. You're right. We do it very much better than so many other nations. Russia, it would seem, would be one case in point.
Eastern Europe, broadly, I'm afraid, still has, and it comes through in sport and in particular football, that Eastern Europe still has a way to go.
Yeah.
But I think there's cause for optimism. You know, maybe they're where we were at in the 1970s, where fools like Jim Davidson yes. had comic characters, you know, that he tried to pretend to have a black accent and have a friend called Chalky,
yes, yes.
you know, who was a black person. I mean, you know, that would never happen now. We've moved on so far. We wouldn't have Absolutely. TV shows like Love Thy Neighbor and Alf Garnett and those other hideous...
Well, in the States, you see, you have got, on a much more subtle basis, but if you watch a sitcom where the protagonist is black, then almost all the supporting cast, and certainly his wife or girlfriend, will be black. Because it has to be segmented like that, you know, and so we do so much better than that. I'm glad to say. Yeah.
But society will take over that because again, even you know, I live in rural Berkshire, but not that I go around with a magnifying glass looking for these things. But you know, one will see mixed background couples all over the place these days, and that's a wonderful thing. That's we know we should be, as Blue Mink once so memorably said, you know, a great big melting pot.
Yeah, I think we benefit from being a mongrel race. None of us are indigenous, except I was going to say, except maybe the redheaded Scots, but of course they're Celts who came from Switzerland originally. So we're not, you know, we are a mongrel race, and we benefit from that because I think sort of genetically. We appreciate, most of us appreciate, that we're all a mixed bag, and you know, it shouldn't be any more significant than that. So you know, our racial background.
We're a rainbow nation, Magnus.
Well, I'd like to think so.
It's a rare week when social media isn't featured in the news, and this week it was the turn of Facebook to appear on the front pages. On Monday and Tuesday, Facebook was, to borrow a cricketing term, we were just talking about cricket, Facebook was facing criticism with a sort of straight defensive bat after it was heavily criticised by politicians and organisations such as ChildNet and its own Safety Advisory Board for giving access to videos showing a woman being beheaded. A spokesman for Facebook on Tuesday said, Facebook has long been a place where people turn to share their experiences, and this video is being shared to condemn it, end of quote. And so the Facebook decision was to leave the content as it was. But by Wednesday, Facebook had changed their stance, saying that they had removed access after, quote, re-examining it. Mm. Well, should they, Magnus Shaw, in the name of freedom of expression, stuck to their original decision, or were they right to remove the access to this material?
Well, interesting enough, I wrote a piece on this on Tuesday when the story broke for another publication.
Right.
And, of course, by Wednesday, you know, a lot of my comment was redundant.
Overtaken.
Yeah. Such is the fast-moving nature of global news these days. But this whole incident was covered in PR spin, really, and I don't think the truth of the matter was ever really addressed. And that is that Facebook, as a company, completely depends on its advertising model, and the value of the company is all based on its user figures, and. Therefore, it is in Facebook's interest to restrict as little as possible, and certainly not to restrict content that attracts an audience. And depressing though it may be, videos like that will bring in an audience. And that, I think, is behind Facebook's reluctance, at least initially, to censor this particular video and videos like it. They are always reluctant to pull stuff from Facebook that might drag in a crowd. And I think it's as cynical as that. Witness the fact that 24 hours later, the roar of objection became more of a problem than the potential lack of traffic or loss of traffic. And therefore, they changed their mind. I don't think it's anything to do with free expression. Anybody using Facebook is at liberty to condemn the most horrific violence witnessed in these videos without posting the video and thereby, you know, subverting any prurience that might drag people along to have a look at it. So that's all that needed to be done. Is they say, yeah, you can set up as many Facebook accounts as you like, condemning videoed makeshift executions, but we don't allow you to post the video in case, you know, people have an ulterior motive for watching it.
What a cynical way to run a business, you know. I mean, it's not the first time they flip-flopped. I mean, I remember back in May, a similar furore was caused when there was shown clips of people dying, and then there was a fuss, and then they were removed. Sometimes, I take your point about, and it's interesting to get that background, which I wasn't really aware of about how and why it happens. But sometimes, and this is why I'm thinking of somebody senior at Facebook, someone has to take a decision to intervene for the greater good and then be judged on that decision. You know, I'm all for the free market, but anything that causes unnecessary harm or distress, well, you know, we've got no need for that. And so sometimes in life, you can't just let everything run and see what happens. Sometimes you do have to intervene. And I think this is one of the cases. And if it had caused, you know, a tiny drop in sort of advertising, I wouldn't have thought I would want to run a company where I thought, well, the kind of clientele I want to attract through my advertisers is people who want to see people being beheaded.
Well, I should stress that I don't believe that Facebook figured there was an advertising book to be turned by hosting this video, and we'll come on to the fact that they weren't really hosting it anyway.
But no, I do want to
ask about exactly that, yes. But that's not really what I'm saying. And of course, in the past, advertisers have insisted that Facebook prevent their ads from appearing next to this kind of content. So by actually allowing this content, you could say, they are damaging their advertising model. What I'm saying is the value of Facebook is predicated on the fact that it has, what, a fifth of the world's population as its membership. And therefore, their knee-jerk reaction is to never do anything that will slow down that traffic, because their share price is based on that. And investors will want to know why they are, you know, introducing policies that slow down the traffic. It's a broader policy than, you know, somebody sitting down and saying, I bet we could drag in a lot of advertisers if we allowed videos of beheading. I don't think that happens. I think there's an overall policy of allowing as much as possible, because that's what brings the traffic.
Yet, I think I'm right in saying that YouTube over here, has far more robust guidelines and doesn't authorize any what might be called adult content. Mm-hmm. But yes, I want to bring us back to a point you mentioned there, because I rather feel, and this aspect fascinates me, I rather think that politicians, right across the political spectrum, I'm not picking on Mr. Cameron because, you know, he was at the forefront of speaking about this during the week, but I'm fairly sure politicians right across the British spectrum still don't understand how social media works. And you mentioned there about hosting. Now, this is something I genuinely don't know. I've got an instinct that Facebook doesn't actually host these videos. Aren't we following links to an outside source, or is that how it works?
Well, you're absolutely right. The people pontificating on these issues never seem to understand exactly how the technology works. It depends what you mean by hosting. As far as I'm aware, you can embed videos into your Facebook page, into your timeline, your wall, or however you like to describe it. Does that mean that you are then you are then accessing Facebook's code and making Facebook host the video? It sort of does. What it doesn't mean is that Facebook has that video on its server.
Ah, that's the thing. I think that's the crucial point, isn't it?
Yeah, but to the user, to the visitor to Facebook, there's little difference, or there's no difference really, in the front end experience. Yeah. If somebody has used code to pull the video in from elsewhere, then the effect is the same as somebody using code to pull the video in from Facebook's server.
But can we hold Facebook to account for that? That's the thing. Not. Do you think we can?
Yes, absolutely, because Facebook is a published website, if you like. I mean, it's a social network, but, you know, to all intents and purposes, it's a website. And you, if you publish a website, which you and I do, you have to be responsible for what appears on that site, or appears to appear on that site, because it appears under the auspices of, you know, of your branding. And you know, equally, the ads that appear on Facebook, which Facebook is more than happy to pick up fees for, are also probably pulled in from elsewhere. The logo that goes with the ad or whatever is almost certainly pulled in from a remote server. But Facebook are publishing, by any definition of the word, that ad. So if Facebook, and this is the case, have built a technology that allows anybody, almost anybody in the world, to add to its content, then they have to take responsibility, because they are publishing that content. You know, it's not that different from a publishing house, let's say Random House. Or whoever, I should add, Random House haven't done this, it's just the name I pulled out of the air. Publishing, you know, jihadist material under its imprint. To take the old model, Facebook is allowing material to be published under its imprint, and it therefore has to take responsibility for what is published. Just because somebody can do it instantly and Facebook may not have realised they've done it is neither here nor there.
If I were to go out after this podcast and let's pick on Tesco, I was going to go to Tesco supermarket, and on their wall I was to write something extremely offensive about somebody or something. That wouldn't be Tesco's responsibility. They're hosting it. It's their wall. Mm-hmm. And I've written something disgraceful on there. Mm-hmm. But it's my responsibility. I did it. If I was picked up by the police in doing so, they wouldn't say, and by the way, Tesco, I'm taking you to court because you've allowed him to host this terrible comment on the wall. And that's surely what you're arguing with what you've just said. Because how can Facebook, how many people did you say are members? A billion or something, is it? I don't know.
No more, it's five, isn't it? I don't know, maybe
lots of people.
Yeah, lots of people. Yeah,
millions,
yeah,
and
yeah,
millions of people.
Let's call it a billion.
Okay, call it a billion. How on earth are they'd have to have a million people checking, you know, everything that was ever posted, wouldn't they? How can they be responsible? No, I don't agree with it. Whether that's the legal definition, you know, I'm sure you're right. But I think people should be responsible for their own actions, just as I am. If I go round to Tesco and write something appalling on their wall, I am responsible for it. I don't see any difference between those two models, posting something up on Facebook and writing something on Tesco's wall.
Oh, yeah, but we're talking about policy here. And on Tuesday, Facebook said their policy was to allow this material. So they've made a conscious decision to intervene on behalf of the people posting or embedding links to this video.
Fair point.
By Wednesday, they despite their strident opposition to censorship, had bitten the censorship biscuit and decided to change their mind. So, and what I'm talking about is policy, really. I'm not saying it's easy or even possible to prevent you, I, or anybody else putting something up on Facebook right now which is objectionable, but what I'm saying is Facebook have a responsibility to say that it doesn't want you to do that, and will take action against you when it comes to their attention. What I'm talking about is their policy towards its users and its content.
I think it's no coincidence that this and similar subjects crop up, and they crop up on this podcast every few months. You know, if it, Ask FM, Twitter, Facebook. You know, we've talked about the various aspects of their policies and how people feel let down by them quite regularly. So there seems to be no immediate answer.
Other than what we talked
other
about,
other than policy,
policy, and you know, it's very easy for me to say this, very glib, and somebody would say, "Well, go on and invent it." But an internet passport.
Yes, we've talked about that before, and I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah.
So you can access all this stuff completely free, but you have to prove who you are before you can go about doing it, and then you can be tracked back.
Owning the responsibility yourself, which is, I think, where we can agree on that at the end of the day, people are responsible for their own actions and need to be accountable for them.
Absolutely. And, Facebook say people were embedding this video in order to condemn it. I'm not sure that I buy that. I'm not sure that I buy that.
No, I don't at all.
I think people would I think some people would have been embedding it for sport. People are, stupid like that, and will do that. So that's what I mean. But I think, the Facebook's initial response was fluff and bluster. That wasn't why this video was on Facebook, in the main. And if people wanted to object to the behaviour of the people in the video, and dear God, who wouldn't? Then they could do that without revealing the video. But and there's an issue of context as well, because had this or parts of this video appeared in a serious documentary about kidnappings and torture in various parts of the world, then I would have no objection to that, because it was part of a larger tapestry of explanation.
But it would probably have been shown well after the watershed,
right,
with warnings right, left, that's and right, centre, yeah, and pixelated bits and so on and so forth. So, we're in the sort of outlaw country of the internet, where regulation is virtually impossible on the global.
Well, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
But place, yeah.
So I'm not suggesting that material like this should never appear, because I do buy the argument that exposing it in the right context, it reveals the noxious behavior of the people involved in it. But inverted commas friendly social network like Facebook doesn't lend it that context.
Well, to a slightly lighter subject, as this week saw the final of the increasingly popular The Great British Bake Off. I say slightly lighter because what should have been a warm, cuddly finale where the remaining three women baked, piped and whisked to determine the winner, it all turned rather ugly, with social media once again at the hub. One participant in particular, 21-year-old Ruby Tando, has been the subject of rather grim tweets on Twitter, which I won't relay here. And even the subject was Ruby, the subject of a bizarre rant from the ever publicity hungry Raymond Blanc, the Keith Vaz of the kitchen, who said, not much skills, female tears, and a winner so thin who makes me doubt of her love for great cooking, end of quote. After the final was broadcast, Ruby Tando took to Comment Is Free on the Guardian website to share her despair and anger about what she called misogyny and gender politics. So are we at a point now where even the gentlest of entertainment is subject to the rolling pins and vitriolic source of nastiness from newspapers, Twitter users and the like?
Yeah, we probably are. Clearly we are. The problem is that we now have far more channel access to the media that we consume. The media is now a much more of a two-way street than it ever was in the past. So, when you and I were young and we would watch the Pebble Mill at One or whatever, we could rant at the screen. We could point at somebody and say, look at that ugly so-and-so. We could see a band play on the old radio success and say they were rubbish or that they were life-changing or whatever. And it went no further than the years of our mates or our beleaguered parents sitting in the room with us. It's different now. So all that comments, intelligent or daft, can now be placed on a platform which is almost as popular as the program that we're watching, with a similar audience. And that's what people do. People have always said daft things at people on the telly. The problem is they can now do it to an audience of 6 million rather than an audience of six sitting in the room with them who will, you know, once upon a time could have cuffed their ear and said, shut up, I'm trying to watch. So this kind of commenting is nothing new. It's just that there are now platforms available on which to comment that are extraordinarily powerful. But I think to an extent, we've just got to look through it. We've just, I could have predicted that somebody somewhere would have said something stupid about the winner of Bake Off, and as they will with the winner of X Factor and so on and so forth. Hopefully, you know, there's a vast majority of social media users will actually make, you know, poignant or humorous points and just ignore these buffoons and idiots who frankly just embarrass themselves by doing this stuff. And Romain Blanc should know better, really. He's quite a slim fella himself anyway. What's he on about?
it's just another short quote from Ruby Tando's piece in The Guardian. She says, if a show as gentle as Bake Off can stir up such a sludge of lazy misogyny in the murky waters of the internet, I hate to imagine the full scale of the problem, which, of course, links in with the comments we were just saying about Facebook. But I just think it's indicative of the direction of travel that anyone on TV now is judged, as you say, in that fleeting moment, on their looks, a camera angle, a throwaway comment. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know, I just don't think that's progress.
It's not
progress. I'd rather be where we were in Pebble Billet 1
That's exactly my point, is that we haven't particularly gone backwards or forwards. It's just that there's this readily accessible mouthpiece for those daft comments that people have always made. But it's important that we don't view it as some kind of psychopathy that's infected society in the last decade. It's just that we're more aware of it because the platforms are so much more visible. And I'd hate for anybody who's had a fabulous experience taking part in the Bake Off thinking that somehow they shouldn't have bothered because a few idiots have got idiotic opinions, because a few idiots have always had idiotic opinions. They just stand out to us more now.
Yeah, this is true. Well, continuing with the food theme, it's never occurred to me, I don't know about you, Magnus Shaw, but it's never occurred to me to lust after prawns wrapped in thin slivers of bacon. And after watching Iceland Foods' Life in the Freezer Cabinet on Monday, BBC Two, 9 o'clock PM, I still have no desire to do so. Prawns in blankets, they had a rather grey tinge to them, as did the CEO of Iceland, Malcolm Walker, who seemed to be a pleasant fellow, but rather devoid of a personality, which is something of a drawback when a camera crew is following you around for a year. But what I'm aching to know, Magnus Shaw, is did this programme inspire you either to want to dash out to Iceland and pick up their doner kebab pizza, or indeed join the Iceland team with their black and grey stripy shirts and nylon fleeces?
What inspired me to do is to try and collar hold of commissioning editors and say, we've done this. We've done this already. This sort of fly on the wall at a company thing is now been done to death, hasn't it? And then unless you can find a company that is so extraordinary that it gives the whole format a different hue, then I don't really think we need to do it again. And Iceland isn't extraordinary or extraordinary enough to give the format that lift. It would be much more interesting to see a fly on the wall at Facebook, for instance. You know, perhaps that would be a different matter altogether. Or, you know, a fly on the wall in the cabinet room. or the West Wing of the White House. But a frozen food company, I just don't think there's enough going on to make this compelling. And there's, you know, the sniggering behind the back of your hand at the odd concoctions that Iceland flog. But We all knew that, didn't we? We knew that they had these odd things like the kebab pizza and everything. I don't know what we were really supposed to learn from this, other than Iceland is pretty much as you thought it would be. I think it might. I mean, this is a series as well.
Apparently
yeah,
so,
yeah. I mean,
yeah.
I think you can probably build a one-off docu-soap about a company like that, but a series is, except that the producers fell a little lucky, because I think in the next couple of weeks it's going to show how Iceland were exposed to the horse meat scandal, and they couldn't have foreseen that, and that might make for some slightly more interesting viewing. But other than that, it was pretty much what you'd expect from cameras following the proceedings of a frozen food company.
Tell you what I learned from it. It wasn't learn from it. It confirmed something to me. Was why I could never do a real job, because I just did. You see, well, you would have seen the bit motivational sessions with singing and high fives.
This goes on in an alarming number of companies, isn't it? Because we had this with the call center docu-soap.
Yes,
they were at it as well, weren't they?
They were. There was community singing in Dublin at some god awful conference. And later that they had, oh God, Magnus, the head office Christmas party at Chester Racecourse, and there was another sing-along, shopping in an Iceland wonderland.
I know.
I couldn't work somewhere like that. I couldn't.
No, I couldn't do all that. You know, I couldn't. You know, you're right. But this is not peculiar to grassroots companies like call centres and frozen food outlets. You know, this. What they call team building, you know, this motivational stuff has infiltrated every level of industry. You know, there are marketing companies and you know, probably broadcasting companies that do the same thing. I would have. It just seems to be a modern trope, but it is awful. I used to do a lot of advertising work with a very, very well-known national supermarket, and they ended every meeting. And this might give it away, everybody had to stand up and chant the name of the company whilst patting their back pocket.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah.
But at the end of every meeting in the company, that had to happen.
It's chilling. That's really chilling. Sorry about the pun, because we're talking about Iceland. But that's, you know, like sort of North Korea activity.
And you always have to do something humiliating. I don't know.
Yes.
Why, if you're going to have a sort of company tradition, can't it just be to pat your colleague on his right shoulder blade or open a packet of biscuits? Why does it have to be something humiliating, like acts like a 10-year-old? I don't know why that has to be. Interestingly enough, I was also many years ago involved with a project for Iceland to establish how well their internal communications worked and what staff attitudes were towards Iceland as an employer. All I would say is that the results that we delivered back to Iceland were very different from the testimonials we saw on this program.
Interesting, because, yes, the staff gave the appearance, or, as you say, within the confines of this program, of being very happy and, you know, pleased to be taking part.
This was years ago, and the whole thing may have changed, but that was not the review we took back to Iceland when we did the work for them. So
there was a couple of things I picked up on which really weren't part of the, you know, to be, sort of be discussing the style of the program, the documentary, but that just troubled me. It cropped up that staff are paid £6.90 an hour, which seems to me extraordinarily low. Maybe out of touch, I don't know. But what made me think that it was terribly low was the extraordinary fever with which some of the employees reacted when they realised that they had won a sort of bonus, essentially, where the CEO came in on a helicopter and delivered a suitcase full of £10 notes. This was shared amongst the staff, and I believe it was something between 250 to few hundred more pounds each. And a lady said, when her store won a bonus, this means I can decorate my daughter's bedroom now. And I thought, well, if you're working for a company where, yeah, exactly, we're winning a bonus for getting wows, as they put it, your customer had to say, I was wowed by Iceland or something, means the difference between whether you can decorate your daughter's bedroom or not. I'm out of touch, I accept that. But that, to me, seemed a pretty grim way to be. That's a very hand-to-mouth existence,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, yes. Well, yeah, such is the reality of minimum wage jobs, I guess.
I know. It that part just struck home to me. Just one other thing that I picked up on. They were saying, oh, I much prefer working for Iceland. I wouldn't want to work for Aldi. And the reason she gave was that Aldi staff on the tills have to scan, allegedly, it was said in the programme, 1,000 items each hour. That you have to, that's their target, to scan 1,000 items each hour. Now, I worked that out, man. That's 17 items per minute,
yeah.
Which means you have to scan one item every 4 seconds.
What if it's a quiet day? What if...
I was going to say, what about when you're taking the money off the customer and putting it in the till, or a customer says, how are you today, dear? And you say, can't stop, got to scan.
And that assumes a constant throughput of customers, yes, doesn't it? Yeah,
it does.
Yes,
1,000 items an hour.
I know, amazing. I mean, and we are so, you know, privileged to work in an industry that doesn't impose these A, ridiculous rituals, and B, these absurd targets in exchange for very small amounts of money. We're lucky that we don't have to do that, you know.
One last thing I wanted to ask you, because this really is your world of expertise. This may seem a very naive thing to say, but the packaging of Iceland's products, to me, looked really cheap. And what I want to know, is that deliberate? Is it a stance that they take?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they don't carry a finest range or all the best range. You know, the major supermarkets all carry a premium range, don't they?
Yeah, a Tesco finest, yeah. And others have similar.
That's right. Yeah. And they don't carry one of those because, Iceland's market position, and it's a tiny market position as well. I think they have 1.6% of the market or something. Is sort of more egalitarian than that, shall we say. I mean, they position themselves, and they really led that Aldi cars, aren't they? Aldi and Netto and Lidl. They led that charge, and they were in place long before those supermarkets. And, you know, they are a frozen food outlet for, you know, people on... you know, compromised incomes, if you like. And so their packaging, it reflects that. Yeah, so the packaging is designed to reinforce that idea that you can always afford your stuff at Iceland. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this was Iceland Foods, Life in the Freezer Cabinet, BBC Two, 9:00 PM Monday, directed by James Rogan for 10 Alps. And as Magnus said, it's part of a series, and the topic for next week, the next episode, is the discovery of horse meat.
Yes, we might get a little bit more lively in the next one, I must say.
Well, I certainly hope so. It was an interesting-ish hour. I wasn't looking at the clock, but as you say, it's rather a bit overdone. We've had the call centre, we've had the chicken shop, and all these other sort of behind, you know, fly on the wall inside businesses. So perhaps we could do with a break from that now, please, TV commissioners. But from the bewildering world of supermarket promotions, to the calmer waters of the pretend iPod. What's that, says the new listener. Where have you been, is my response. This is what happens. My colleague over there, Magnus Shaw, but there he is, over there. He and I select a track, and we tell you what's good about it. We play you a snippet of each at the end of the podcast, and more importantly, we plonk it on an ever-growing playlist on the Rocking Vicar website. So... what's the recipe today, Jim?
Well, listen, I've picked the Velvet Underground, and, you know, listening to the fuss made about the Velvet Underground, and particularly that first album, of course, you'd think they were second only to the Beatles in the 60s hip band stakes. But in fact, they were all but ignored while they were together, at least together for the first time. merely being Andy Warhol's factory house band and plaything, really. I think it was only when Lou Reed made an impact as a solo artist and big buddy of David Bowie, and particularly with the Transformer album, that the Velvet's material was then reappraised. And boy, was it reappraised by almost everyone. You know, from the Banshees to Echo and the Bunnymen to Jesus and Mary Chain. Post-1977, it seems almost every band with a surfeit of dark glasses seized on the Velvet Underground as a major influence. But, you know, not without reason. There's not every note, I must confess, produced by the Velvet Underground was impeccable, not by any means. But with that dark experimental psychedelia, songs like Heroin, Venus in Furs, Waiting for the Man, they were obviously pushing boundaries at least a decade and a half before those boundaries were ready to be pushed, which is probably why they were ignored in their own lifetime. Personally, I tend to favour the Velvet stuff with Nico on vocals. They tended to split the vocals between Lou Reed and Nico. I really like that chilly, Teutonic, slightly off-key voice that she brings to it, slightly more affecting than Lou Reed's stoned drawl, although that does have an appeal. Nico's a bit like an American Marianne Faithfull, really. She had that compelling otherworldliness to her. Although, sadly, she didn't survive the rock and roll lifestyle in the way Marianne did. But that's why I picked All Tomorrow's Parties for my track this week. It's from that banana-fronted First Velvets LP that we're also familiar with now. By the way, the original editions, you could peel the banana off, which is a bit of an Andy Warhol trait, but obviously if you go out and buy it now, you can't, which is a shame. I think somebody should repress that LP with the peel-off banana. That'd be nice. There's something queasily hypnotic in this song. It's that circling, looping backing, but also that intimate attractiveness in Nico's, as I say, off-key singing. She couldn't hold a note, but that's part of the charm. But perhaps above all, it's just like a wonderful melody, All Tomorrow's Parties. A cool, dreamily surreal lyric just adds to the attraction. And this isn't something that was alien to David Sylvian either, because he clearly spotted this when Japan produced their splendidly louche version of All Tomorrow's Parties. And who am I to argue with David? He was once voted the most beautiful man in the world. And interestingly, Nico was once named the most beautiful woman in the world as well. So Velvet Underground's All Tomorrow's Parties makes it onto the Pretend iPod this week.
Yes, it's an interesting and good choice. I've never been able to warm particularly to the Velvet Underground. Largely, I think, the aspects that you've covered there, in the fact that Nico couldn't hold a tune if her life depended on it, and Lou Reed, I know this is a sort of a blasphemous thing to say, but not blessed with the greatest vocal either, and I don't like curmudgeonly people in the public eye. If you're going to want to produce songs and perform them, then be accessible and cheerful to your public. You know, the fact that he goes round, it's kind of the Van Morrison thing, isn't it, where he goes round, every interview he ever does usually ends in despair, tears, or either he or the interviewer walking out in disgust. Those kind of things put me off, rather. Individual tracks, Soft Boys used to cover Train Coming Round the Bend. I used to love that, and as you say, there's some great songs on this Banana album, Waiting for the Man, Femme Fatale, Sunday Morning, Venus in Furs, and so on. So that's really good. I think All Tomorrow's Parties is probably the best track on it. So it's a good choice. But do you like them sort of as a band, or is it just that this track particularly appealed to you?
I quite like them as a band. I think they're sort of one of those bands that are much more interesting in retrospect. To see the slots that they found for themselves after their initial existence in music history, which is the Velvet Underground always have to be viewed retrospectively because of the influence they had on so many other bands. So I think I'm more interested in in their influence than loving them to death as a band. I had a friend at, when I was at college who would have laid down his life for the Velvet Underground, and I Crikey. Don't feel that so passionately about them to that extent. But yeah, I think that first album is very, you know, it is a bit of a classic, but I think it has had to grow into that skin. Because of so many other musicians who've taken from it.
Yeah, well, I don't buy the new Musical Express, but if I did so this week, I suspect I would probably find out that the album that you've just talked about, the other Velvet Underground and Nico, would pop up in the New Musical Express this week, because they've published yet another of those top 500 albums of all time lists. Mm. And that album, the banana one, the Velvet Underground and Nico, tends to crop up in those. Always, got higher than those lists.
I've said this before about those lists, though, is that you can write them before they're published, because there's that,
well, yes.
You know, there's only a finite number of albums which deserve to be on such a list, and they're always on it.
Well, speaking of writing them before they publish, I mean, I think always these top 500 albums of all time type things, as you just alluded to, they're always of little value, because, well, especially when they're genuinely based on votes, because when I worked in radio and we ran, I particularly remember the best singles of 1982, I simply filled the chart in myself with my own favourites. Yes. And simply didn't bother counting votes for the Kids from Fame or Shake Stevenson, thus ensuring that Dex is an ABC one.
Yeah,
everything.
Oh, that's quite right. nothing wrong with a bit of gerrymandering, is
no.
But yeah, that's the thing with these charts, is that I think it's settled. I mean, I think that's the point. I think we've decided what the top 500 albums of all time are, yes, broadly speaking. And they always ignore, you know, techno or house or to a larger extent hip hop, don't they? So we're talking about white rock albums, and I think that's pretty much decided, you know. It's just slightly different order each time they publish.
Slightly different order. They do tend to change depending on which way the wind blows in that sense. But if you believe the New Musical Express, The Smiths, The Queen Is Dead, is the best album ever.
Yeah, apparently, yeah. better than Ziggy Stardust and Nevermind the Bollocks, and better than London Calling. Yeah.
London Calling.
Yeah, isn't it interesting, though, that all the hacks at, a bit of a derogatory term, all the journalists at the New Musical Express are almost certainly of an evening tucked up in bed reading the Morrissey autobiography.
Yes, yes. Well, my own favourite artists of all time, they don't ever seem to change, but that's probably because I'm stuck in a sort of time warp. But this week, my choice comes from one of my top five groups of all time, if I was to compile such a list. And they deliver one of my top five singles of all time, if I was to, again, deliver such a list. So up there with the Beatles, the Clash, the Silver Seas, and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, I have PM Dawn. May surprise you if you know me, but their first two albums have shared my life, really, for the last 20 years, and we're still very happy together. The second album, the Bliss album, is one of my favourite albums of all time in all of the universe, but inexplicably, it's not on Spotify, so I can't point you towards anything from that particular album today. So let's step back to PM Dawn's first album, the wonderfully titled Of the Heart, of the Soul, and of the Cross, The Utopian Experience. Tricky getting that on a CD.
Yeah, it's never in the top 500 albums of all time list, because they can't fit it on the page.
Can't fit it on, yeah. And I select from it track 9, Set Adrift on Memory Bliss. If you've never heard it before, or you haven't heard it in a long time, I urge you to listen to the end of the podcast, because you'll be able to hear a little snippet. Or better still, go to our pretend iPod and play it in full. Set Adrift, it's a festival of sampling. Of course, taking its melody from Spandau Ballet's True, but also sampling Joni Mitchell in the lyrics, paying homage to Joni's Hissing of Summer Lawns album and the track Boho Dance. Also with further lyrics referencing songs by George Michael, the Pointer Sisters, and A Tribe Called Quest. It features the heavenly vocals. They really are of Atrell Cordes, who's known as Prince B. And, incidentally, the video is a gorgeous psychedelic explosion of colours. This really is pop music at its inspirational best. Set Adrift on Memory List, it's my karaoke song.
there's something we don't need to hear.
Exactly. Recorded in London at Berwick Street Studios and released in August 1991, reaching number 3 on the UK Top 40, number 1 on the Billboard Hot 100, 4 minutes and 10 seconds, PM Dawn, Set Adrift on Memory Bliss.
Yeah, it was such an enormous single at the time, wasn't it? You couldn't move for that record when it was around. I was a DJ. Rather than a radio DJ, it was a nightclub bar DJ when this was a hit, and it posed an enormous problem because inevitably every few minutes somebody would come up and say, can you play the PM Dawn record? But of course it would kill the dance floor stone dead. We didn't have sufficient beats per minute. So yes. It was always like, oh, do I play a record that everybody wants to hear but kill the dance floor, or do I decline their request? So it caused me untold problems, but it is a lovely track. If you remember, I interviewed Tony Hadley a few weeks ago, and off mic we were talking about various bands that had been influenced by Spandau, and he said he always loved the PM Dawn track, and he actually did a
cameo in the video. So
you didn't mention that. Oh, that was humble of him. He didn't say, well, and I was in the video, you know. but when's PM Dawn these days? What are they up to?
Ah, well, I can answer this. It's a bit of a sad story, actually, because the chap I mentioned, Atrel Cordes, who is the singer, the bigger chap, known as Prince B, first of all, he had a stroke not long after the first three albums, and that left him paralyzed on his left-hand side. He still continued to perform live after that, but sadly, about 4 years ago, I think it was 2009, he had a second stroke, and to give it briefly, it ended up with him having his one of his legs amputated, and he's very bad health altogether. So they're kind of in abeyance,
hiatus.
Yeah. That was the word. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Haven't released anything since the late 90s, 2000, because of his health, unfortunately.
Well, right, a shame to hear that, but at least, you know, he has that legacy of that huge single that everybody, at least of a certain age, is going to remember, aren't they?
They had quite a number of top 40 hits over here, and in the States, of course, but parallel here. The second album, the one that I really loved, the Bliss album, had Boy George guested on a track called More Than Likely, that made it to 40. Mm-hmm. Here, Looking Through Patient Eyes, which was a remix of a George Michael track, to number 11 here, Die Without You, number 30. So, yeah, they had quite a little run of hits, but you can't beat Set Adrift on Memory Bliss. A hit all across the world.
Yeah, it was an enormous record at the time. Oh, excellent. Good choice. And I hope if anybody had forgotten it, we've pricks their memory, because it's worth hearing again. But unfortunately, PM Dawn send us scurrying to the pantry for a marmalade doorstep and a glass of Nesquik, because it is time to say goodbye. So let's say thanks to Monsieur Decombe.
Thank you, Magnus Shaw. See you in a week.
Input and carefully ironed pocket handkerchief. And a bigger thanks to you, of course, for listening. We always appreciate it. And I tell you what, let's come back in 7 days, because we'll do it all again then. Bye-bye.
And what part do Sarah Porter wear? To all tomorrow's parties, a hand-me-down dress from who knows where? To all tomorrow's parties. Where will she go? What shall she do when midnight comes around? she turn once more to Sunday's clouds and cry behind the door.
Careless whisper from a careless man. A neutron dance for a neutron fan. Marionette strings are dangerous things. A thought of all the trouble they bring. An eye for an eye, a spy for a spy. Rubber bands expand in a frustrating sigh. Tell me that she's not dreaming. She's got an itch in the hole that doesn't have meaning. Reality used to be a friend of mine. Cause complete control, I don't take too kind. Christina Applegate, you gotta put me on. To the cake with Jack Bourne. She broke a wishbone and wished for a sign. I told her whispers in my heart were fine. What did she think she could do? I feel for her, I really do. And I stared at the ring finger on her hand. I wanted her to be a big PM Dawn fan, but I have to put her right back with the rest. That's the way it goes, I guess.
Baby, you send me
media production.
So why not come and visit us for the experience of a lifetime? No matter what your tastes, interests or budget, Iceland is a destination guaranteed to surprise and entertain. This is a land you will never forget.
No, I meant the store, not the country.